Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Independent journalist Dar Jamail joins us for the half hour to talk about what he sees as the most important news stories about Iraq. After reporting from Lebanon during the Israeli-Lebanon War, Dar Jamail returned to writing about Iraq for Interpress Service, IPS News Online at ipsnews.net. We start by listening to a segment of audio from a talk Dar Jamail gave in Boston, October 25th, 2005, about his 8 months of coverage from Iraq.
The targeting of ambulances by the U.S. military was practiced with enough vigilance in Fallujah that even the Iraqi Minister of Health on April 17th publicly pressed Paul Bremer to account for it. Bremer explained that the U.S. authorities believe ambulances to have been used by fighters, offering as a response the very definition of collective punishment. Another doctor that I interviewed inside Fallujah at the small clinic said this, quote, "The Americans shot out the lights in the front of our hospital. They prevented doctors from reaching the emergency unit at the hospital, and we quickly began to run out of supplies and much-needed medications," all of which, of course, are violations of international law. He went on to say, "Not less than 60% of the dead are women and children. You can go see the graves for yourself."
At that time, Dar Jamail was calling on the U.S. press and members of Congress to take a more truthful look at the war he'd been covering for 8 months from Iraq. In May of 2005, Jamail went to Jordan, and he was one of the only journalists from the U.S. to interview the 500,000 Iraqi refugees living there. Early on, he had written about torture going on in U.S.-run prisons, the destruction of Fallujah, and U.S. military attacks on medical personnel in Fallujah during two sieges in 2004. He wrote of failing medical systems, reconstruction failures, Bechtel's failure to decontaminate drinking water, and the steadily increasing death toll. After an early start as an independent without many media contacts, Dar Jamail's work took off as more and more international media outlets came to recognize the importance of his on-scene coverage. Now his work has been translated into 10 different languages, and he's been published in Interpress News Service, The Nation, The Sunday Herald, Islam Online, Asia Times, The Guardian, The Independent, and many other publications. During his travels, Dar Jamail has reported for Pacifica's Democracy Now! And Flashpoints. In addition to reporting from Iraq, he has also reported from Syria, Lebanon during the Israeli-Lebanon War, and Jordan. Dar Jamail has been touring the U.S. and Hawaii on a speaking tour and is also just back from Europe, where he appeared on Danish national TV. Dar Jamail is finally taking the time to collect his thoughts for a book. Dar Jamail, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me, Dori.
Dar, your website, Dar Jamail Iraq, is so full now of all your many articles and lectures. You've been going to Europe to speak. Just talk about your latest trip there and tell us what the climate is there as the situation in Iraq continues to be terribly chaotic with violence.
I was recently over in both Sweden and Denmark, and it was a really interesting trip, mainly by how the information I was giving to people was handled by even the mainstream media there. It was much more open, much more receptive to broadcasting the information I was giving out. Just to give you an example, just while I was in Denmark alone, I was on a national television nightly news program called Deadline. I was on a national radio program. I was interviewed by at least four newspapers and a couple of different magazines as well. Just very, very broad exposure. We figured by the end of that trip that we got information out to over 1 million people in that country alone. Contrasted back here to the U.S., where the only time I've been on a national program was just at the end of last week, ironically. I was on National Public Radio for a five-minute segment, and of course, that was after a 20-minute interview. We were talking about the Iraqi hospitals, and I talked about U.S. military attacking hospitals and shooting ambulances and impeding medical care, which is, of course, a war crime, but of course, that part was cut from the interview. While ironically contrast that to the exposure I had while over in Europe, the mainstream media there, while quite imperfect, of course, was still not reluctant to go ahead and broadcast everything that I was saying.
it's not as if the reports that you've been sending home when you were in Iraq for 8 months or any of your other reports have not been proven to be true. And later on, we see the mainstream press picking up on at least some of the various details, not telling the story as you have. But at least we certainly know that your reports have been borne out.
It's true, and it's been very interesting to watch, whereas European countries and their mainstream media are reporting things far more rapidly than the mainstream media here in the U.S., and the information is out there, and it's interesting because I'll even sometimes be contacted by people within the mainstream media outlets here to help put them in touch with someone in Iraq, for example, to get them particular information. But I never see any of that information come out in any of their reports ever.
Very interestingly, too, we've been talking a little bit about media, and we've touched on some of what gets on CNN. Now, we've seen stories about tens of thousands of Iraqis leaving the country. Violence is rampant there. Death squad violence is continuing. NPR has reported on the refugees a little bit. But CNN's reporter, Arwa Damon, even used the term ethnic cleansing in one of her recent reports. Dar, what do you see as the key stories that Americans should be paying the most attention to if they're interested in working to stop the war?
Well, I think if they're going to talk about ethnic cleansing, they need to be talking about what is the root of these death squads in Iraq, because that is now the leading cause of death in that country. When we look at, it's very well documented that retired Colonel James Steele was working under the then U.S. ambassador to Iraq, John Negroponte. James Steele was in charge of the Iraq security forces. In fact, his title was counselor of Iraqi security forces, and he reported directly to John Negroponte. These are the same two men who's helped set up and facilitate the right-wing death squads in Central America in the 1980s. Under the watchful eye of Ronald Reagan. And they did the same thing in Baghdad. So if we talk about ethnic cleansing and sectarian violence and the millions of refugees, let's talk about the core reason that these happen, and it's the U.S.-backed, formed, armed, and supported death squads. They're supported by the United States to this day. So I think that is probably one of the most unreported stories to date, where, once again, we have the U.S. mainstream media conveniently decontextualizing the situation. We'll talk about what's happening after. We'll talk about the death and blame it on the Iraqis, the classic blame the victim game. But we won't talk about who instituted the entire process and who's behind it, and that is the U.S. occupation.
Now, we have heard recent reports that the U.S., the government, the military, even some members of Congress have expressed an interest, shown interest in talking with, negotiating with some of the opposition, if you will, although that's pretty hard to define right now. But we've heard some reports of the U.S. seeking to have dialogue with Muqtada al-Sadr's people, for example. So let's be specific about who we're talking about when we say that the U.S. is supporting death squads. Which groups are you talking about, and how can you identify some of the facts for us?
The groups that the death squads were pulled from were the largest militias in the country. One of these is the Mahdi Army, which is the militia of the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Another group is called the Badr Organization. It was called the Badr Army previously. It was since renamed. It is another Shia death squad, which is basically the armed wing of the dominant religious party in the new government, which is SCIRI, Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iran. The Badr Organization is an Iranian-backed and armed militia, one of the largest in the country. The third group is the Kurdish Peshmerga militia. It's from these three groups that the U.S. has pulled people and formed the death squads from. So it is quite ironic if they're making signals that they're willing to talk with people like Sadr and, of course, people like Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who is the leader of SCIRI, who Bush is, of course, talking with, because these two men alone are directly responsible for the burgeoning number of dead Iraqis. These men are without a doubt criminals. They're without a doubt the arm behind their own militias, which are acting as these death squads. And these are the men that Mr. Bush is meeting with. And, of course, they will not be talking about the use of these death squads.
Now, what would happen if American forces left and there was no more coalition force occupying Iraq? Would these death squads move into more of a position of political power? How would that look?
I would argue that they would not, because all my sources on the ground in Iraq are saying that the only reason that this government exists and the only reason that these death squads are able to function is because they have total backing from the U.S. and from the occupation forces. Just to give you an example so people have an idea of what this looks like on the ground, the consistent report that I keep getting is that the U.S. military will go in, for example, to a Sunni area of Baghdad and seal off that area, and then while it's sealed, allow these Shia death squads to go through their perimeter into the neighborhoods to conduct killings, to conduct home raids, and to detain people, and then bring them back out that U.S. perimeter, and then the U.S. will pull away and leave. They're essentially using these death squads to do their dirty work, and these death squads would not exist without the U.S. there. Because right now, if we look at the situation on the ground, even this month alone already, we're barely into December, we have over 31 U.S. deaths in that country just in the first week of this month. It's over 180 attacks a day being carried out by a primarily Sunni resistance against U.S. forces. So if the U.S. left that country, instead of a Sunni resistance going after only the occupation forces, I would argue that the Sunni resistance would most likely then go after these death squads and dismantle them in a very short time.
What do you make of the appointment of Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense, Dar? Do you think that there's any hope that he will start to demilitarize the situation?
Quite the contrary. I don't see him having any effect on U.S. policy in Iraq. I would point to what I hope that we'll talk about shortly is this Iraq study group to get some ideas of what we can expect in Iraq in the near and long-term future. Robert Gates, I think, is key when we start talking about policy regarding Iran. This is someone who was very, very involved in the Iran-Contra affair, and I think that we should look for him to start making moves on how the U.S. is going to be approaching Iran, which is going to be quite the contrary to using the military less. I still believe that short of massive policy change in this country or some radical shift in the government, meaning we actually have elected officials that represent what the people of this country want to see happen, I unfortunately would have to say that I still believe an attack on Iran by the U.S. and or Israel is imminent.
Now, it does seem, Dar, that there is some dissent in the ranks. Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State Rice, has been moving away from this military option, according to Gareth Porter, who's been on the show. And he talks about the fact that the former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld was for an attack on Iran.
I hope that Mr. Porter is right. And I have read a lot of his analysis over time, and I think he does a very, very fine job. I hope that he's right and that I'm wrong, but I think we would need to see a massive shift in the U.S. policy as well as a massive shift in the U.S. alliance with Israel and their interests in the region as well, because right now I feel that both U.S. empire objectives and the interests of Israel are quite synthesized in the Middle East and working to benefit both entities. And until both of those are shifted, again, I still believe that there's a very high probability that there will be an attack against Iran in less than 2 years.
Condoleezza Rice was, according to Gareth Porter, trying to offer talks with Iran in the context of EU-Iran talks on the nuclear issue and hope that this would lead to broader U.S.-Iran negotiations. We've just seen the Bush administration, George Bush, say that he doesn't want to take the option of meeting with Iran that was suggested by the Iraq study group.
That would be a very good example as to why I still hold to my rather cynical and skeptical opinion about what this government plans to do with Iran, where, God forbid, we even reference someone like Condoleezza Rice as a dove in this situation regarding Iran, which is a bit of a kind of sick joke. She's one of the leading hawks in the administration, but where if she's coming out as somewhat of a dove arguing against attacks with Iran and arguing for political dialogue, then I think we're in a very, very bad situation regarding our our policy regarding Iran. So I would hope that cooler heads would prevail. I would hope that that dialogue would start. But as you just said, Mr. Bush continues to make it very clear with his bellicose rhetoric that he has no intention of political dialogue with Iran and solving those issues diplomatically.
You mentioned the Iraq Study Group report, and that report begins by calling the situation in Iraq grave and deteriorating. But it also happens to have the word oil in it 63 times. And I would call the attention of anyone listening to this program to the website usip.org, the U.S. Institute for Peace, where you can download the whole report in a PDF file. Dar, I know you've questioned the presence of James Baker in the study group, and you've talked about who he is as a kind of private citizen now having a huge impact on foreign policy. Just talk about the Iraq Study Group first in general and your impressions of the group itself.
Yes, James Baker, who also was conveniently on the board of directors of Bechtel Corporation, who was awarded $2.3 billion in contracts in Iraq. Talk about a conflict of interest. A couple of other individuals who were very much involved in this report, another one whose name is Edwin Meese III, who is a member of this Iraq study group that produced this report. He also is a representative of the Heritage Foundation, a very, very conservative think tank in the United States that has been hawkish and very pro-war from the beginning. We also have to talk about the fact that James Carafano was also very instrumental in the Iraq Study Group's report and who's also a member of that Heritage Foundation. So there's conflicts of interest with the people involved in this report. And I think really you summed it up, the fact that the word oil is mentioned in the report 63 times. I think basically this report is a smokescreen, an attempt for the U.S. administration to kind of play the good cop, bad cop game and using this rhetoric like, oh, it's a grave and deteriorating situation, as if, you know, this is going to address the problem. And the bottom line about this study group is it does not talk about any firm dates or numbers of withdrawal of U.S. forces from that country. It does not talk about a legitimate government in that country where Iraqis would have real sovereignty. Instead, it really lays out the importance of oil for U.S. interests in the region. And on page one of the entire report, it talks about the fact that Iraq has the world's second largest known oil reserve. And then it goes on in other areas of that report to mention very specific things they recommend to be done in order for the U.S. to get their hands on more of that oil.
Conditions in Iraq are so bad, and so many people are fleeing for their lives, literally, Dar. I just wonder if we run the risk that the U.S. military options of further bombing of Iraq could be pulled out of the closet.
Well, we're already seeing that today, where 6 children and 8 women were killed in a U.S. bombing raid that killed 32 people in total in a small village northwest of Baghdad. Just the other week, another U.S. fighter jet was shot down by resistance fighters. A couple of days after that, a Marine helicopter was shot down in a lake in Anbar province. So we're seeing a very heavy increase in air power as the situation spirals further out of their control on the ground. As I said before, just in this month alone, so far with U.S. troops, actually, we've had 35 killed. So we're averaging almost 5 dead soldiers a day in this month alone. So far, this has been one of the bloodiest weeks of the entire occupation. And so I think we're seeing an increase in the number, in the use of air power to try to compensate for that. And all it's really succeeded in doing is killing more Iraqi civilians.
Now, again, it's as if some of the media, anyway, is discovering the stories that you were writing about in 2003 and 2004, including the one about Bechtel and their failure to make good on their contract to purify Iraq's water. But in that you have done these reports on Bechtel and looked at the corporate side, I want to call attention to your December 4 story in Alternet, where you talked about business as the next big casualty in Iraq. And you did cite some of the work by Antonia Juhas. Juhas has said that the Iraq Study Group is basically a further pressure on the Iraqis to accept privatization and Western corporatization of their country.
It does very much. You know, I cite Antonia Juhas often because she does such an excellent job of reporting what's actually happening here. And back to the Iraq Study Group, another thing that we should discuss that Juhas has pointed out so well is that of the dozens of recommendations made by this study group to assist the situation of Iraq, let's look at recommendation number 63, which calls on the U.S. to, quote, assist Iraqi leaders to reorganize the national oil industry as a commercial enterprise. Okay, let's talk about why the use of the word oil is in this report 63 times. Also in this recommendation 63 is to, quote, encourage investment in Iraq's oil sector by the international community and by international energy companies. Now, what does this have to do with liberating the Iraqi people? What does this have to do with weapons of mass destruction? What does this have to do with links between Iraq and 9/11? Well, it's all about the oil, and, you know, this Iraq study group makes that clearer than ever for anyone in this country who is still determined to believe that the invasion and occupation of Iraq has any positive reasons behind it whatsoever. If they believe any of the propaganda that this had something to do with helping the Iraqi people or providing security for this country, I would say all they need to do is read this Iraq Study Group report. It's all about the oil. It's very clearly written there what this group's goal is to do. I mean, we look at recommendation number 28, which calls for putting control of Iraq's oil revenues in the hands of the central government in Baghdad. This is just after recommendation number 26, where the Iraq Study Group's call for a review of the Constitution to be pursued on an urgent basis. And that's in order to centralize power in Baghdad because they have direct control over this puppet government right now. And then, of course, we go back to Recommendation 63, which also calls for the U.S. government to provide technical assistance to the Iraqi government to prepare a draft oil law, which that has been going on now for over a year in that country, where as we speak, they are haggling over percentages of production sharing agreements as regards to who gets what amount of Iraq's oil. That's what this is all about. We're seeing that today clearer than ever.
I want to call attention to something Dennis Kucinich has noted about this Iraq Study Group report, which is that 500,000 barrels of oil are being stolen per day in Iraq. That's how he puts it. He says that is, and I'm quoting him now, that is $11.3 billion worth per year. The Ministry of Oil in Iraq has been notoriously corrupt, and we saw people like Ahmed Shalabi involved with it. But also, as Dennis Kucinich points out, some U.S. troops were sent to protect the oil, and then we saw this sort of setting up of an infrastructure around Iraqi oil. Just comment on the way the war has been waged in terms of both this money for oil and the process of pumping it, and the U.S. troops protecting the process.
Again, very, very clear sign, hard physical proof of what the priorities were in Iraq when the only two ministries guarded by U.S. troops, when the rest of Baghdad, including the most important museums and libraries there, were allowed to be completely eviscerated by looters. The only ones protected were the oil ministry and the Ministry of Interior, where many of the important oil records are kept. This was not lost to the Iraqi people one bit. And then when we talk about corruption and smuggling of oil and oil that's gone missing, of course, who are being blamed is the Iraqi resistance and Iraqis themselves for smuggling oil and corruption. But we don't talk about the fact that already as we speak, and since nearly the beginning of the occupation, Western oil companies like Shell and Chevron have been cashing out on Iraq's refined oil and shipping it out of their countries themselves. I wonder if that's being included in the corruption and the oil theft that's being discussed here.
Dar Jamil, we're also looking at a recommendation that meetings take place between the so-called quartet, the U.S., Russia, the EU, and UN, and between Israel and Lebanon and Syria. Now, they're saying Lebanon and Syria on the one hand and Israel and the Palestinians on the other, the recognition of Israel again being the thrust of the argument. Just talk about, though, the insertion, Israel and Palestinians and other parts of the Middle East in general in this report. In a way, that's kind of a startling aspect to it.
if there's a silver lining to this report, it's simply that they do bring up the issue that anyone with a pulse over in the Middle East is all too aware of and has been all too aware of for decades now, is that until there's some resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, there will be no peace in the Middle East, period. That is the baseline that any discussion of the Middle East has to recognize. So it's kudos to the report for at least acknowledging that fact, but I think that's where I would draw the line with my kudos, because the fact is it's extremely biased, insisting that states like Syria and Iran and then the Palestinian people acknowledge the Israelis' right to exist as a state. But where is the flip side of that? Well, where is it that the report might demand that Israel recognizes the Palestinians have a right to exist as a state, you know, at least as much as the state of Israel does? So if they're going to do that, let's at least be balanced and equal-handed in what they're going to recommend as far as a solution to that crisis, where we can't call for an acknowledgement of the state of Israel having a right to exist unless simultaneously we have a calling for the state of Israel to acknowledge that the Palestinians have a right to exist in their own state at the very least.
Talk about the role that the Palestinian crisis has played in, let's say, convincing people about how the United States will treat Iraqis.
Well, it was very, very clear early on in the occupation, and some of the first things I reported on, and probably the first things I ever talked with you about, Dory, because you're the first person to ever do a radio interview with me ever in my time over Iraq when I first started reporting from there. And maybe even some of the things we discussed were the collective punishment tactics being used by the U.S. military. It was very clear that they had been trained, this is very well documented, that they had been trained by Israeli counterinsurgency experts. And that's why we started seeing things like home demolitions and collective punishment being used by the U.S. military as early as December 03, and actually even before that date. So we were talking about that back then. We look at the situation in Palestine, and it's been flashing across Iraqis' television screens for decades now, and then seeing this collective punishment on the ground, seeing the same tactics being used. And I think you could easily argue that this is one reason the anti-occupation resistance in Iraq has been so fierce and getting fiercer by the day, because the resistance fighters in Iraq are all too aware that the longer this occupation is allowed to continue, the more likely it will degrade into something resembling what the Palestinian people are having to suffer through, where we have a decades-long military occupation, where daily these people are being disenfranchised from more and more of their land and what's rightfully theirs in their territories. So people in Iraq get this. That's why I think it's really a no-brainer to say that we can certainly look for resistance to increase, the base of support for that resistance to increase, for it to only get more fierce as time goes on. And the bottom line is the resistance is fully in control of the situation of what's happening in Iraq today. We're about the only thing the U.S. military can now do effectively is drop bombs from fighter jets on civilian homes, killing scores of civilians on a daily basis, which they're doing right now and doing more and more. And simultaneously, we're seeing more and more of those aircraft brought out of the sky by resistance fighters. And I think these trends will continue directly because the situation in Palestine is worse today than it ever has been before. And as that continues to worsen, I think we can watch as resistance in Iraq increases, and that's exactly what's happening today.
Dar Jamil, thanks so much for joining us again to help us understand these complicated problems.
Well, thanks very much again for having me, Dory.
Journalist Dar Jamil reported from Iraq for 8 months, then covered the Israel-Lebanon war. You can find his stories online in various publications, including Interpress Service, ipsnews.net, and you can find much of his work online at darjamiliraq.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS, Radio for the People at the University of Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNation.org and TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussion.